This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning to Great Spirit Sangha again, and good morning to everyone at Jikoji or part of the Jikoji Sangha. I'm going to actually, I'm going to put my headset on. Take a moment because I think that might be ultimately stronger.
Very good. It's wonderful to see the pictures of Jikoji. We were, of course, planning to be there this weekend. And I've been leading sesshins at Jikoji since, 2011. In the last couple of years, we've gone, 5 or 6 years, we've gone twice a year. And I can actually, looking at the pictures, feel my feet on the beautiful bamboo floor and imagine looking out those gorgeous windows to see the woods, turning the corner, watching the hill, and then just watching day and light travel over that hill at the far end of the Zendo. So thank you always to Jikoji for the great generosity you've shown, Great Spirit Sangha. So we are living in challenging times a tad, and practicing in a world that's quite unusual under for a variety of reasons. And we are not the first generation of Zen practitioners to have to practice with difficult times, that's for sure. It's just that perhaps this is our first time having so much to deal with and to practice with. Always the invitation of our practice is to be as skillful in this very world, this very moment, with this very life, however it's manifest for you. Suzuki Roshi said, things just as they are. Always. And Darlene used to say, which I think is an important thing that I keep in mind, if nothing ever changed, how would you find your happiness? How would you live? So we're kind of in a place that sometimes feels a little bit like that. I understand that you have been reading Dale Wright's wonderful book on the Paramitas, and that you're about to embark on the study of the Shantideva's Way of the Bodhisattva. The paramitas, of course, are the training ground, the training tools for how one becomes a bodhisattva. Dana, which is generosity. Sila, or sila, which is ethics. Kshanti, which is sometimes referred to as tolerance, often patience, a patience that, by the way, is inclusive of us as well. Virya, effort, dhyana, meditation, and of course, prajna, wisdom, which can be the hardest one to grasp sometimes. We used Pema's book when it was called No Time to Lose when we studied the Bodhisattva Way in our fall 2019 practice period. And I think many of us really, really appreciated both her commentary as well as Shantideva's text. It's an excellent time to be studying this text because, as I was saying to Great Spirit Sangha last night, now more than ever, our world needs bodhisattvas, people who are committed to living and practicing this way in a world that is, you know, quite hot, quite on fire. But that's one thing that Shantideva starts out the book with and tells us right away. He says, if I can find the page, bodhisattvas practice in the middle of the fire. This means they enter into the suffering of the world. It also means that they stay steady with the fire of their own painful emotions. They neither act them out nor repress them. They are willing to stay on the dot and explore an emotion's ungraspable qualities and fluid energies, and to let that experience link them to the pain and to the courage of others. So there's no hiding for us, and the invitation is for us to enter the world through the particulars of our life circumstances to try and bring this bodhisattva energy to a world that is in need of wisdom and of healing. There are a few things that I know you're going to take a deeper dive into this, but by way of reminding us all in Great Spirit Sangha and maybe foreshadowing some of the key points, I wanted to talk about the things that struck me as particularly important in terms of Pema's commentary and the Shantideva text itself. The first is that, you know, the Bodhisattva way is hard. And rumor has it that it takes a long, long time, maybe several lifetimes. I can't attest to that. I only know this one. But what we do is we wait for everyone to be equally enlightened, awake, aware, committed to the path, having transformed his or her suffering before we ourselves cross over. We wait for everyone to cross over, so we do it together. And that can take a very, very long time. The other thing that Shantideva says up front that's so important is that we have to have intention. It takes a lot of very strong intention to lead this life because it's a challenging one, right? And it's very easy to become discouraged. I mean, look at the circumstances now. I do have some wise hope about the turning of this wheel, as I was saying last night, but it is very heartbreaking to see the causes and the conditions that have brought about the types of murders we have seen in recent years, the type of injustice, the inhumanity. And it can be very discouraging. Some of us on this Zoom might have found ourselves in the late 60s and 70s involved with civil rights marches. Here we are again, right? From that vantage point, it can be discouraging or it can be overwhelming. We think that there's just simply no way that we can make enough of an effort to really change things. So this is why our intention has to be strong, because we have to stay engaged. At the core of being a bodhisattva is this practice of cultivating our bodhicitta, the mind that wants to be awake, the mind heart that is one of love. Love for all beings, whether we agree with them or we don't agree with them. Not a mushy, smushy type of love, but a love that is a grounded love, a love that is more akin to loving kindness, that it respects the basic humanity of all beings. Reb Anderson, in his book on the precepts, Being Upright, talks about this from the perspective that I really like. And he says that in order to live a life of being upright and to be a bodhisattva, the way is really about learning how to generate love and not to generate mental states of mind. He says, states of mind come and go and happiness comes and go, but love can be developed that doesn't come and go. This, of course, is basic karuna, compassion, the counterpart to prajna, wisdom. But we have to have this spirit. We have to keep this in our heart or very, very close to our heart, especially at times like this, when we can feel so separated or we so want to separate ourselves from beings. He wrote this in a different time, but I think it's very applicable right now. As bodhisattvas who are committed to all beings, we cannot leave anybody behind. We can't abandon people. We can't cut them off. And that can be a big challenge. The greatest danger to us, as Shantideva identified it, is that of falling prey to anger, falling victim to anger. And he says in his text, good works gathered in 1,000 ages, such deeds of generosity or offerings to blissful one, a single flash of anger shatters them. So we know anger is one of the three poisons, right? The keshlas, greed, hate, and delusion. And we know how powerful this emotion can be. That's why we have to be extraordinarily aware of it, and we have to be very mindful and very alert to it as it comes into our sphere of being. And we have to really practice very deeply to work with the anger, not necessarily to deny it, to cut it off. We don't want to do any spiritual bypasses, but we have to learn to deal with anger in a skillful way. And anger is a red hot energy, so it requires a lot of effort. The Dalai Lama talks about anger. And I should say, by the way, that for those of you who aren't aware, this is actually a key text to the Dalai Lama's lineage, the way of the Bodhisattva. And every day he chants the prayer that our Kokyo Hana chanted, the Bodhisattva prayer for humanity. And that's the version that he chants. So for him and for his followers, this is a really significant text, a significant teaching to follow. But he also understands how difficult anger is, and he has a wonderful book called Healing Anger. And he identifies in that book that there, you know, a couple of things. One is that there is a difference between anger and hatred, right? Hatred is where we just totally cut somebody off or something off. It's kind of like, you know, a phrase I used to use in my mind and heart years ago, you're dead to me, you're out of my life. And we as bodhisattvas can't do that anymore, right? So hatred is not appropriate for those who want to practice this way. But anger can be useful. I mean, one, if we learn how to work with it skillfully, you know, then we are transforming it. But he also says that anger can be motivating. Look at all the motivation, how motivating it is to so many people at this point in time. Yes, we see the harm. Yes, we see the hurt. Yes, we feel the distress. But look what is mobilizing around that anger that everyone is coming to feel. So if properly directed, anger can actually become a Dharma gate for everybody, if used skillfully, to actually transform, in this case, the suffering of the last 400 plus years as it relates to African Americans. He also talks about, you know, hatred being a very destructive force and one that can lead us into a dangerous and slippery slope as practitioners, which is where we feel ourselves on one camp and then there is, quote unquote, the other, all those other people with whom we don't agree, who we don't necessarily admire or appreciate, but nonetheless who we put into a separate category. He says that there are two types of anger for us to be aware of. One is the anger of the moment, right? The heat of the moment, something that happens. The second type of anger, and perhaps more pernicious, is the anger that we hold on to. Some of us might know this from the perspective of resentments that last, oh, in my case, maybe a decade or two. But it's the type of anger that is very, very dangerous because in part, there's a justification. Oh, I'm okay in feeling this type of anger, right? And the second piece of it is that it is very corrosive. To hold on to that anger is very corrosive. It can be particularly dangerous because it engenders these corrosive resentments and fixed ideas that can reinforce themselves and reinforce this false idea about justified anger anytime being justified. And that can, again, really amplify this feeling of a separate self. And these feelings of separate self, of course, are not what we're trying to do in terms of following the Dharma of no self, of being, of interbeing with the world, of being in harmony with all beings. The antidote to anger is patience. So, you know, spoiler alert, the paramitas that you studied in Dale Wright's book, Shantideva, and Pema will take you all through them again, but that's wonderful. They're a lifetime practice. They're a lifetime practice. And patience is kshanti. Sometimes it is called tolerance, which I just a personal preference. I like this term patience because it feels a little softer. Tolerance kind of makes me feel like, I'm just tolerating that person as opposed to cultivating. But that's all wordsmithing. this patience really helps us in a number of ways in terms of dealing with anger. For one thing, if we have patience, it can help interrupt the momentum of anger. Everybody in this Zoom Zendo, has experienced how once anger gets unleashed, it has a momentum of its own, right? And it can just spiral out of control. With practice and with patience and attention to the anger, we can actually learn how to interrupt its flow. And ultimately, hopefully, interrupt it sooner and sooner to the arising of it before we've done anything unskillful that would either harm somebody or cause deep remorse in ourselves. Pema Chodron writes, it helps to learn how to relax with the edginess of our energy once we become angry. And I think that's something that we all know, right, in our bodies, how quickly my body changes when I cop an idea that's based in anger, right, or when I feel that level of passion and heat that I'm right, somebody else is wrong, that I've been hurt or wounded. Why on earth did that happen, right? That's unfair, whatever it is. We feel it in our body, which is an important thing to do. It's an important piece of our practice to really drop down into that anger and to explore it and to work with it in our body, but also to make sure that we're aware that we're angry. I think some of what I personally have experienced, let's just say since 2016, is that it's kind of like the frog being in the water that gradually just keeps getting hotter and hotter, right? And I don't sometimes even know that I am angry or how angry I am. So the working with patience, working with Kshanti can help clue us into this and can make us more aware of that edgy energy in our bodies that we can work with, that we can learn to harmonize, to calm, to soothe. Because when we learn how to soothe ourselves, then we have a greater chance of being skillful in whatever the situation is. And in all of this, patience is also helping to create more space in our minds, in our hearts, and our bodies. And when we have more space, we have a little bit of distance again from that quick uprising of anger. And in that space, that is when we have the opportunity to make appropriate choices, to not be so enthralled or imprisoned by the reactive mind. Anger, action, right? With patience, we can feel the anger, but we can put the space in between the anger and the action so that hopefully we can come into alignment with our vow to act in a way that is skillful with our anger by either, you know, stopping, pausing, attending to our own sensations, or by finding the right neutral words to respond to a situation or the right action. It gives us a chance to really understand, too, the complexity of a situation that has made us angry. I mean, if we just think about all the issues regarding Black, the injustices to the African-American population, regardless of who specifically has been murdered, and sadly, there have been so many, too many. We can understand, if we step back, how incredibly complex the situation is. First of all, the karma of it goes back to Jamestown, right, in our country, and goes back longer than that. But this is 400 plus years. This is not going to be solved overnight. We have to cultivate wisdom if we are going to participate in helping to find a beneficial, enduring solution to this. But if we just act out of anger, we're not going to be able to see or to participate in the nuances of responding appropriately to something that is so, so complex. And that's true of any situation, but it's particularly true of right now. And patience helps us in general to cultivate and to abide in a mind that is less reactive, right? So a couple of benefits of that. One, we maintain more mastery over our own thinking, emotional reactions, and subsequently the actions that we embody. We don't forfeit our equanimity to others or to situations. We retain ownership of that as bodhisattvas who are committed to having that equanimity and to dealing with the anger. And this process really also gives us much more capacity for patience itself. It kind of feeds on itself. With all of these perspectives, all of these facets of what patience can do, you can see that it really gives us a shot of continuing to stay engaged, but doing so in a very skillful way without forfeiting our own freedom, our own peace of mind, our own equanimity. Most of us have also experienced that acting out of anger does very little good. I mean, I have rarely been satisfied by after I've had a tantrum, which is not my style. I'm not a hot, angry person. I'm kind of that ice queen sort of person that, oh, you're dead to me, but I'll be very civil to you. But my heart totally closes down, right? But it allows us really to stay open-hearted, soft-hearted, and in so doing, we allow more opportunity for the ability to connect with those who have made us angry, connect with the people that we disagree with, as opposed to separate from them. How will we ever find ourselves out of this situation skillfully, or any other situation where you find anger arises, if we don't keep that platform of connection for the possibility of exploring what the issue is and what the possible solutions are, right? Otherwise, we're just going to keep perpetuating throwing gas on the fire. And that's what we've been doing. And that does absolutely no good. With practice, we give ourselves this chance to find a skillful response to our anger under all circumstances. Now, none of this is to say that we are to deny our anger. As I said earlier, actually, we turn toward it. We don't touch it, we don't hold on to it, but we turn toward it with awareness, neither touching nor turning away, the jeweled mirror samadhi, right? We turn toward it with awareness and with our intention, our vow to work with it skillfully. If anything, we have, we get to know it better, and hopefully we can bring compassion for ourselves for being angry. You know, a lot of times we feel, especially as Buddhist practitioners, oh, I shouldn't be angry. I should be beyond that. No, we're humans. We should feel that. It's just a question of how what we do with it. So have compassion for ourselves when we are angry and we start to judge ourselves or we dislike the state. It's part of being human and it can be extraordinarily instructive. And if we can bring curiosity to this process as well, we will be well aided. You know, Pema talks a little bit in her commentary on Shantideva, but it's another kind of standalone teaching of hers when she talks about Shempa, the hook, right? We get hooked on something before we even know it, and we're off to the races with anger or with some other emotion. So as Buddhist practitioners, what we want to do is we want to understand our processes so that we can avoid to the greatest degree possible being hooked. One, because it causes suffering in ourselves and we don't want to do that. Our whole effort is to transform our suffering so that we can have greater peace and ease and equanimity of spirit, but also because then we don't want to have people suffer or be tinged by our unskillful actions out of anger. So this, to study this and to really learn, where do I get hooked? Why am I so angry about this situation or that situation? And what I was talking about with our the Great Spirit Sangha last night that I think is really important is to be very clear in our, to try and be very clear, it's a practice for me, that the people that are embodying the actions that we don't, that aren't consonant with where our hearts and minds are, where our belief in the Dharma leads us in terms of values, that it is not those people that we are, They are the problem, but it is more their actions. And we have to be very, very careful in terms of walking that line, that again, to a whole category of people, we don't say, you're dead to me, you're horrible, you become the other, right? And I have to say, again, since 2016, I myself have found this a very robust practice. One practice that Shanti Deva suggests that I have found very, very helpful is this practice of exchanging self for other. I think the first time I experienced it, I hadn't even read Shanti Deva. And it was during a period of time in my life when my beloved younger sister was dying of cancer. And, you know, I'm not like this anymore, I assure you, but I used to be a little snarky when I came to four-way stops and some people would act out of turn. And I would start to cop an attitude about, they're wrong, right? How could they? What's wrong with those fill in the blanks? But during this time when I was in incredible grief and distraction because of my sister's dying, I actually often found myself at four-way stops going out of turn. I was just in a different realm. Now when I come to a four-way stop, I think to myself, and somebody acts out of turn, I think to myself, oh, maybe he or she has a sister who is dying and they're distressed. Maybe he or she is late to be by that person's side while they're going through chemo. Maybe that person just got a horrible health diagnosis. We don't know. We don't know what it is, right? And so this exchanging self for other. Zanna gave a lovely talk about 2 months or so ago, and how she phrased it was, just like me. So maybe that person driving through the four-way stop out of turn is just like me, and guess what? I am just like them. A great equalizer during this time when there's so much energy that could be directed toward separation. So as I mentioned, this is a long path that we're committed to. I don't know, maybe the good news is if there are additional lives, it ensures many more lives in this world. And if I get to hang out with people like you, I'm up for it. We don't do it perfectly. We have to be very, very careful of that. I think that many of us as Zen practitioners, Buddhist practitioners, are so, so hard on ourselves. We think, oh, now I've heard this, I should be perfect at it, but that's not how it works. This energy, these habit energies are so long standing, so well established, so powerful that we have to just keep persistently working at them. But we have to be very, very kind to ourselves during the process. Otherwise, as Shanti Deva says, we'll get discouraged and we'll give up. So when we find ourselves at those times, please be sure to introduce compassion, genuine compassion for yourselves. This is not an easy practice. Otherwise, if it were, we'd be further along and there would be many, many more people doing it, right? So that speaks to the ardor of it. It does require this great intention, or as we say from a Buddhist perspective, vow. And it is so helpful that we continue to take our vow every day, however you might do it, by bowing into your altar, putting on your rakasu, or joining in on full moon ceremonies, to be reminded of our vow, that we vow to do no harm, right? That is basically what the life of a bodhisattva is aiming at. So the thing is, though, at the end of the day, if we want to live an upright life in alignment with the Dharma, and if we want to experience both the comfort, the ease, and the protection, the self-protection that living in alignment with the Dharma brings us, there really is no other game in town. This is the way. This is the way to go. Pema's book also suggests, I gather that her new book, her new version of it is titled Becoming Bodhisattvas. But this particular book, which I'm sure some of you may be familiar with, No Time to Lose, the previous version, is actually, I think the title is extraordinarily timely, right? The times really don't give us a lot of latitude for taking our time and going at a slow turtle pace. This is the time for all of us to show up as best we can to do this work and to bring some healing and some balm into this world of ours. What we do really does matter. Whether it is a big effort or if it is a small effort, it all counts and it all goes forth and culminates in the total effort. So have trust and faith that this life of a bodhisattva and everything that you do in your own lives to embody it really does make a difference in this world of ours, in your own immediate heart and mind and sphere, but also in the larger world. Absolutely. You know, as Buddhists, we're in a practice that fortunately, you know, invites us to take care of our suffering. So as we find ourselves struggling with this being a bodhisattva, we have to also take care of ourselves. You know, this is the classic, remember when we used to ride airplanes with a certain amount of carefree spirit, and they would say, be sure to put on your mask before you put on the mask of a child. We have to make sure that our own Dharma tanks are full, that they're not running dry. We have to transform any suffering that we might experience along the way by virtue of this being a difficult process or encountering, you know, challenging situations and challenging people. And we have to take this piece of our practice very, very seriously. So it's important to recognize the suffering. It's important, like I said, the frog, you know, really to step back and to take our own temperature, to do a scan, body, heart, and mind. How are we? How are we doing? Because all of this is happening. I mean, you know, it's kind of like, I feel like I'm living in the bullseye of concentric circles that keep expanding. My first little, I mean, the world was challenging enough prior to 2016 election. And then that became a very strong circle for me to practice in. Then we have many other things, but we also have COVID, which brings very strenuous practice circumstances to all of our lives. And now we have this outer ring, our most current ring, which is dealing with trying to find ways to rectify the injustices of the last 100 years, right? So there's a lot going on, a lot of impact, conscious and unconscious, on our hearts and minds and bodies and lives. And we have to take care of ourselves if we're going to be able to participate in the process of offering healing and engaging in the solution. And we have to give ourselves credit for good effort. None of this happens overnight. It didn't happen overnight for Shantideva. He was actually much maligned by his fellow students. It's a great story. Somebody else can tell. But all of us, everyone who is a past Buddha and ancestor was like us and had circumstances to deal with. It's about progress, not perfection. And so please don't be hypercritical with yourselves, because again, that contributes to discouragement. And then we're more likely to abandon this very important enterprise that we're all have embarked upon. We have to make, though, a special effort during this time, because of all of the circles that I mentioned, to be sure that we know what nourishes us and that we partake of that nourishment in sufficient quantities, right? Whether it's art, many people in our Sangha are actually quite genius at turning their feelings, their experiences into art that's offered up for others. But I'm sure that in the process of making art, they also find great solace and satisfaction and contentment and nourishment. So art, poetry, nature. Yesterday, while Allison and I were on a mostly meditative walk, we were down at Crystal Springs and we came across 5 deer and 2 little Bambi babies that were probably a month or two. They still had the spots on their skin. And it was just thrilling. It was thrilling to watch them. And they let us watch them for quite a while. And it was so nice to change gears, right? I think one of the things about self-care and nourishment is learning what is your sorbet, the sorbet of your heart and mind, right? So that you can clear the palate. Otherwise, the stuff keeps accumulating and it wears you down. But seeing these deer, and of course, in a setting where, you know, it's all this beautiful, soothing green with this luscious smell of bay. So we have to learn how to do things like this. We have to make a little bit more effort, put our shoulder into the wheel to entertain and introduce into our lives nourishment. I, at the nearly ripe old age of 68, am taking a piano. What a great time. So, you know, it brings me joy. I always wanted to learn how to play. And if anyone would like to hear via Zoom or something, a stunning version of This Land Is Your Land, I'd be happy to entertain you. Very moving, very moving. So this is really important. And again, as bodhisattvas, sometimes we can get confused and we can say, no, all of my energy has to go toward others. No, I tell you. You have to practice the first precept, not kill yourself, but learn how to affirm yourself and the very precious life that you have been given, the very precious life that all of us have been given. This is a deadly serious, no pun intended, or juxtaposition intended. This is a very, very serious matter, especially now under these incredibly stressful times. So we have to find pleasing ways to take care of our life. And finally, we have to really trust our intention, trust our effort, trust that the path that we're on that we have chosen, that we do make a difference and that what we do does matter and is beneficial. And we have to find, in conjunction with our nourishment, we have to find joy. We have to find things that bring us joy. Those deer brought us so much joy watching them. And it was nice to feel joy. My eldest's three little kids bring me great joy, right? So we really have to know how to do that and plug into that that energy at this period of time. So to that end, I want to read a poem, not a new poet, and a poet that I have read before, standard, and I thought I had earmarked the page. I had. Jane Hirschfeld, who actually practiced at Tassajara, right, and has had Jukai and doesn't, you know, make a big deal about her Buddhist practice, but I think for anyone who knows her body of work, you can feel it, right, just behind the words. So to this point of joy, I'd like to offer all of you this poem called Salt Heart. I was tired, half sleeping in the sun. A single bee delved the lavender nearby, and beyond the fence, a trowel shoulder knocked a white stone. Soon the ringing stopped, and from somewhere, a quiet voice said the one word. Surely a command, though it seemed more a question, a wondering perhaps. What about joy? So long it had been forgotten. Even the thought raised surprise. But however briefly, there in the untuned devotion of the bee and the lavender fragrance, the murmur of better and worse was unimportant. From next door, the sound of raking, and neither courage nor cowardice mattered. Failure, unaccountable failure, did not matter. Soon enough, the gate swung closed, the world turned back to heart salt of wanting, heart salts of will and grief. My friend would continue dying, at last only exhausted, even his wrists thinned with pain. The river suffering would take what it wished of him, then go, and I would stay and drink on as the living do, until the rest would enter into that water, the lavender swept in, the bee, the swallowed labors of my neighbor. The ordinary moment swept in, whatever it drowsily holds. I begin to believe the only sin is distance, refusal. All others stemming from this. Then come. Come rivers, irrevocable futures, come even joy, even now, even here, though it vanish like him. So in the midst of her suffering with her friend dying, she reminds us all that joy under all circumstances is always an important practice for us. So I think in closing, I would just offer a favorite phrase from Master Dogen, our medieval Japanese founder. During this time and always, please treasure yourselves. It was true then in 1200 Japan. It's just as true now. Thank you very much. So, Nico, what should happen next?
Thank you, Cynthia. If anybody has any questions, comments, etc., just go into Gosho and please feel free to unmute yourselves if you can. I think you should be able to, and just proceed.
Am I unmuted?
Yes, you are.
We can hear you.
Okay, thank you. Uh-huh. I've never heard those chants that you used in the service this morning. They were beautiful. Where could I find a copy of those?
We would be happy to, well, we've sent them all to Nico. So Nico, you can distribute them, right?
Oh, great.
The Bodhisattva Prayer for Humanity, as I said, is one we started chanting when we were studying the way of the Bodhisattva, Shantidevas. And it, as I said, it is the Dalai Lama preferred version. Makes it the Cadillac of chants. And Harmony of Difference and Equality is pretty standard. The Echo is one that I created, but you are very welcome to it.
And this Shantideva, was that the name?
It's the Way of the Bodhisattva by the Indian saint, and his name is Shantideva. They're kind of equivalent at this point. If you say Shantideva, most people know that you're talking about the Way of the Bodhisattva.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's hard to navigate this screen to see if anybody else has a hand up. Looks like we might be good, Nico.
I think people can just jump in if they'd like to. Connie, I see. Hi.
Oh, okay.
Connie is muted.
Okay, thank you, Cynthia, very much for your talk. A very beautiful talk. And I've been leading the discussions at Jokoji on the Paramitas, and I think how you wrapped up anger and self-compassion and patience was just beautiful. And in fact, it felt like such a well-rounded presentation that it's hard for any questions to come up because it's like so understandable how you presented it. So thank you so much. It was really very wonderful to listen to your talk today. I have a question about welcoming anger as a friend. Mm-hmm. Because oftentimes, you know, when I'm angry, I'm better able to do this now than when I was younger, but even still, sometimes it comes out. I repress it, and it comes out as sadness, and I can't direct it out, so I turn it around and direct it at myself. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you have any insight into how to make it more of a friend where it doesn't attack me internally.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that if we befriend anger from the vantage point of trying to make it something neutral, right? So maybe you could start by working with your own, investigating what are your own judgments about anger. For me, as I started this practice, and I am, of course, continuing it, but as I started this, I was aware that for me, everything became frozen. My embodiment of anger was, you know, came across as you're just dead, because I didn't know how to work with my anger, and I was afraid of my anger. I really thought that my anger would either kill me, or out of my anger, I might do harm to somebody else. So it was better just to contain it and hold it in and become this kind of ice queen, as I said. But the thing about anger, and the reason why I think all beings, but especially bodhisattvas, need to be aware of this, is because if we don't get it out in a direct, forthright way, it's going to come out sideways. And out of that coming out sideways, it's probably going to come out in ways that are unexamined or unintended. And I say come out sideways, it could affect other people and hurt them. Or as in your case, the sadness, it's affecting you, right? So to try and cultivate some curiosity and some neutrality, I like to introduce very neutral words like just anger, right? Mm-hmm. It's not that it's worse. I mean, and it's absolutely true. We were talking about this a little bit last night in Great Spirit Sangha. The teaching of non-discriminatory wisdom says that all things are equal. So there's a way in which anger is just, you know, the same as love, but it's really a question of what we do with it. But I think maybe to start by thinking about how it might overwhelm you and try to both introduce neutral words. Sometimes it's very helpful to put some sort of an intentional ritual practice around this very lightly. Like, I don't know how you bow into your day if you sit or light a candle or something, but just to offer, may I wake up to learning how to deal with my anger more skillfully? Can I increase my capacity to hold my own anger? The power of our intention and the power of vow is never to be underestimated. So those are a couple of quick thoughts.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
I wanted to say thank you very much for the talk. I really appreciated.
Yes, I see you.
I really appreciated your the metaphor of the intersection. And when your younger sister was dying, I thought it was very poignant to think she's younger. She's going beyond. She's going first. She shouldn't go first. Mm-hmm. And I think about that intersections a lot in my own life. How sometimes something arises and I think, well, I'm not ready, or I'm in a hurry. I wanna get there. And I'm not talking about physically getting there. I'm talking about developmentally in some way or in a relationship. So I find this conversation about intersections really powerful, because as we encounter any kind of meeting with a person, a sangha, our loved ones, it's an intersection. You know, it's not just me in that intersection. It's not just I. There's at least one other person, and maybe, you know, multitudes of me and multitudes of the other person. So I just wanted to say thank you for mentioning intersections. It seems like a big deal to me.
Right. And this is, I think, one of the beauties of practice, with who knows when it's going to finally, we'll come to some sort of realization about it. But it's not like this is rocket science stuff, right? This is the mundane, ordinary elements of our lives. It's like I could have an epiphany and my heart and mind could soften and expand some more at a simple intersection. This is why we should never diminish our lives and think that practice is outside of ourselves or somewhere else, or someone else is doing it better, or we have to climb the mountaintop. No, just stay in the intersection. Thanks for that that metaphor. You're reminding me that maybe I should use it more. Thank you very much, Pamela.
Bob Sedevi.
Yes, just a short comment. One of my teachers, Yoko Yama-san, always used to say, the bodhisattva path takes a lifetime to master. The sooner we begin, the the longer it takes. Or I could say the Bodhisattva path takes several lifetimes to master. The sooner we begin, the longer it takes. So let's get going.
That's exactly right. That sounds about right. Thanks for sharing that.
Xixian.
Thank you for that wonderful talk. Blanche Hartman, my teacher's teacher used to say, take care of the equipment. Do you have any advice on how to take care of the equipment or take care of ourselves without becoming slothful?
Well, I think some of the things that I mentioned, and thank you for bringing Blanche into the conversation and into our Zoom Zendo. Blanche was probably after Darlene, my heart teacher, Darlene Cohen. Blanche was my sewing teacher, and I studied Dogen with her before Dharma transmission, so she's very meaningful to me. And for those who don't know Blanche, she was the former abbess of Zen Center and the first female abbess of a major Soto Zen center, and wrote there's a beautiful collection of her talks called Seeds for a Boundless Mind, if I'm not mistaken, that I heartily encourage. Very sweet, short, accessible things. So I think that this taking care of the equipment are all the things that I was talking about in terms of taking care of our lives, making sure that we're rested, right? Making sure that we're aware of what we have to deal with, self-awareness in terms of what's our anxiety level right now, what are we working with, and then knowing truly how to soothe ourselves, I think is very important. And it is not, it's not a, sitting in beds and eating bonbon type of thing. It's really, I don't even know, do people sit in bed and eat bonbons anymore? But you guys know what I mean. Binging on Netflix or something like that. I think that our own bodhisattva vow, our own Buddha nature, and our bodhicitta mind that wants to be awake is not going to let you cross over the line for too long into being slothful. This is where I think you can probably maybe trust yourself a little bit more. And if you are operating in the jewel of Sangha, you're going to have a lot of people, especially your teacher, maybe giving you a poke here or there saying, okay, enough of that. Now you need to move on. But I think at this point in time, I wouldn't worry too much about anybody becoming slothful. I think the times are so stressful and demanding that we really do need to take this practice of self-care very, very seriously. Michael?
A quick, muted again. I can't unmute. Am I unmuted now?
You are unmuted.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry to speak again, but the anger issue, I've always understood that, the anger is a justifiable anger is a luxury I can't afford. Mm-hmm. It's a slippery slope with this anger. I've never heard, it's the first time I've heard anyone speak to this the way you did. Which is good. I mean, I'm an angry person, and how to harness that in a useful way is tricky to me, because I feel the anger immediately. Like I liked your four-way stop, because when I come to a four-way stop and somebody does it, I feel this tightening of my body, and it's like autonomic. I know that's when I'm angry, and I guess I'm going to have to try to find a way to use that skillfully. If you have any advice on that.
Well, there are many ways, but I think that you're on the right track. I mean, the first thing that I would say is we have an opportunity, and kind of what this paradigm of being a bodhisattva offers us is just being conscious that we don't want to act out of this with reactivity and do something that, again, is just as another harmful act that creates more anger. So that's not what we want to do. But to take that anger and to really plow it into transforming our own anger, or doing something that, depending upon what might really be touching you at this point in time, there are so many opportunities for working on this very, very large national, well, actually global enterprise of turning the wheel on injustice, right? Whether it's by donating money, whether it's making calls, you know, not everybody feels comfortable enough to show up at protests, but doing things with our lives can be one way of taking the anger, the energy of anger, redirecting it and plowing it into something that's more skillful. But the other thing too that I would suggest that I have worked on very deeply in the past is to feel my own anger in that moment, to feel what it feels like, to become familiar with it in a very minute fashion, to feel how it causes my shoulders to tense, my jaw to clench, my heart to kind of race and tighten, and to take breath, right? We're in a breath-based practice, and the invitation is to live a breath-based life. So to use our breath to learn how to soothe ourselves and transform our suffering can change things very quickly, and it's always available to us.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Sure.
Thank you so much for the talk, and just a lot to take in. But I think my question is about, I'm not sure if it's about anger, but I think, I know during this time or even like before, sometimes I feel like really lost or like, it just like, that kind of uncertainty made you feel frustrated or something. And you're trying to get a lot of information, trying to find, mm-hmm. you know, what's your mm-hmm. purpose or meaning of life, this kind of thing. But mm-hmm. it's just really hard to grab. So I don't know any suggestion on that. Like, how do you deal with uncertainty or, mm-hmm. you know, I know that I want to live a meaningful life, mm-hmm. but yeah, sometimes I think it's quite hard to grab what exactly is that. And I kind of feel like stuck in this, no matter it's a skin or age, it's a struggle. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some feel. Mm-hmm. I wish yeah. I can just throw everything away and just, I don't know.
Start fresh, go to another planet maybe or something
maybe
like that.
Maybe another planet.
Who knows? We might all feel very different in a few months, but who knows? I think that your feelings of confusion are very, very natural. And what I think the confusion also has, what I'm hearing, is this incredible tone of overwhelm, which I think you're paying attention. I mean, there's a lot going on, right? There's a whole lot going on, and we don't know how it's going to turn out, right? But first of all, that's how life always is, right? We never know what's around the next corner. We never know how the next moment is going to unfold. This is basic dharma. This is impermanence. This is uncertainty. So we don't know how the world is going to behave, how, you know, people in our lives are going to behave. So there's always that feeling of uncertainty. But you answered your question yourself in that you said, you know, you want to lead a meaningful life. From my vantage point, I would equate that as saying, from a practice perspective, I have entered into a life of vow. And my life is to lead, my goal in life and what my life is all about is trying to be skillful and to do no harm and to take appropriate action. And it's a crapshoot. Sometimes it's right and sometimes it's wrong, and that's okay. I just go back and I start it again. So you already have the right intention. And my teacher used to say, when we enter a life of vow or intention, right, we want to do something meaningful, then everything just becomes grist for the mill. There isn't misfortune. Uncertainty goes away in a certain degree, because what is clear, what is irrefutably clear, is our intention to do no harm and to be skillful. So the other teaching I would offer is a very old one, which is cultivating don't know mind. Whatever the circumstances, this world is more intensified with a lot of uncertainty. But as I said, that's always the way life is. So what we do is we try to learn how to rest and abide in don't know mind. But if we're buttressed by and with this intention to live skillfully, that's never away from us. We always have that. No matter whatever else is going on, that is something that we can really that is kind of the ground of groundlessness, if that makes some sense. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Wonderful, wonderful question, and such a common experience for all of us. Thank you.
Arn Verma.
Thank you. Thank you for this wonderful, wonderful, wonderful talk. Like one of the things that really resonated with me was when you mentioned that it is so important for us to plug into the joy within us. And mm-hmm. I remember there was a time when I would not let myself be happy unless everything around me and everyone around me was happy. And like there would be always something which would be off. And I remember reading this quote from one of the sutras, and it really hit me then. And then your talk was a very, very nice reminder of them. So I wanted to share those quotes with everyone. So this here's how it goes. It says, "Live in joy, in love, even among those who hate. Live in joy, in health, even among the afflicted. Live in joy, in peace, even among the troubled." And I feel like these quotes are so true, even in this environment, and it's so important for us to find that joy and plug into that joy. So thank you for that. I want to share that. In addition, I had a couple of questions regarding some of the subjects you touched upon, including anger and hate. So my first question regarding that was, do you think anger and hate both have fear in common, that like both of them originate from some kind of fear? And then my second question was that, where does anger become hate? Where does anger become hate? Does hate originate as anger and then goes into that hate sphere, or are those things originating separately?
So regarding your first question, what do you think?
I think the fear is the source, the root of these mm-hmm. things, and I wanted to get your perspective on it.
I agree wholeheartedly. And it's kind of going back to the last question or comment, which is fear of uncertainty and our lack of kind of trusting, will we be okay, right? And from a Buddhist perspective, in this very moment, always we're okay. Yeah. And your second question, yes, I think that, you know, I'm not a extremely fluent as a from a psychotherapeutic perspective, you know, DSMV or anything like that. But I do think, according to the teaching of Shantideva and then the Dalai Lama's commentary on it, that unchecked anger is can be very corrosive and can spiral into hatred, into a more intensified. And so maybe that's what's behind hatred and distinguishes it as opposed to anger, that it's altogether a more intensified experience of both that anger as well as the fear, you know, which is why it's so easy to hate the other, because they can be so threatening and appear so fearful to us.
Hello.
Okay, thank you very much.
If I may ask two questions.
Surely.
First, what is the difference between passion and anger? Because there are a lot of people who use passion as a means to do things. And some of that ends up being creative and good and, you know, do things. And yet other times isn't very healthy, the passion being overwhelming. That's the first question.
Okay, I think that anger can be a subset or have it share a border with passion, but I think passion is something bigger. Passion can be both beneficial and unbeneficial. It can be skillful and unskillful. And I think that anger could be redirected, could become passionate, like people who are out there protesting, leaders of movements who start movements use their anger in order to become very passionate about something. But it can also just be a life energy. Like I am very passionate about Buddhism and living the Dharma, right? So passion, I think, has many, is multifaceted and has many, many facets to it. And anger can, I don't think passion equals anger or anger equals passion. I think that they can be related though.
Okay, thank you. The second question, it has to do with sadness. I find it incredibly sad about the protests going on right now, in all ways. You know, one side, the other side, it doesn't seem, all of it causes me to feel sad. Primarily because the symbolism that is being used, the underlying energy symbolism question that is being used with the protests isn't revealed. It isn't shown. There's labels that everyone has used. This is this, this is this, this is this. But the actual underlying basis for the change that is going on now has not been even talked about. And that is sad to me, because if it isn't talked about, then they'll be fixing the symbols without fixing the underlying basis that created all the symbols that we are experiencing. And to me, it is so hard to watch that. And yet I have no way of fixing it other than to say, this is really sad. So how do I not be sad anymore? Really?
Well, I think that you know, you're expressing being basically a human. You know, sadness is a totally appropriate response to what's going on. It's not the only response, and you might want to look at what else you are feeling, or you might want to explore, is sadness a default switch that you tend to go to when things happen? I don't know, and I'm, you know, not trying to get personal here with you or judgmental, just offering suggestions. But I think that there is a certain amount of sadness to what's going on. My Dharma brother Stephen in our Sangha gave a talk yesterday and very much encouraged all of us to get in touch with all the different types of sadness and the grieving that we are all doing. I mean, I can't pick up my little 5-year-old or my 3-year-old without worrying, right? I haven't touched either one of them or cuddled them in about 3 months now. That's heartbreaking, right? So there are all kinds of things that are sad. I do think, though, in terms of the energy or what I'm feeling about your larger question is that, you know, part of the patience that Shanti Deva is talking about is appreciating exactly how complex situations are. And this situation of what the nation is going through right now is really complex. It took 400 years plus to get here. It's not going to be resolved overnight. And, you know, we have the opportunity to choose how we perceive something. Myself, as somebody who did a lot of demonstrating in the 60s and the 70s, I kind of feel a little hopeful. I haven't seen this level of national protest happening, people trying to at least at a first-time basis express that they think that what's happened is unfair, that they don't want to support it, that they don't want to stand by it. So it also takes time. I mean, you know, we're dealing with a lot of things that are institutionalized, from our political system that is already fairly, you know, constipated, if you will, and dysfunctional, to, you know, not having the appropriate leadership to find the path forward on this. But what I take heart in is that there, I can feel the energy that people's intentions and our desires are pretty strong now to find that pathway out. And this is where we, from what feels like the edges, can bring our own energy and our own words, our own actions in to try and help to shape this. again, in big ways and in small ways. But I hear what you're saying. I really do.
Thank you.
No, thank you. Nico, I'm afraid my sangha is going to leave me if I don't get go back to them. We're a little over schedule, although it's wonderful to be with all of you, and I so appreciate your engagement. So thank you all very much. And Nico and anybody else who's left from Jikoji, again, we miss you desperately, hopefully sometime soon.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.